Thank you for downloading the African Studies Seminar podcast, presented by the University of Oxford's African Studies Center.
This is a paper that's in fact currently it's in press with a journal. It was co-authored with Adrian Brown, as Nick mentioned. And Adrian has the distinction of being a master's graduate from our program here in Oxford from last year, who then went and joined the British Institute in East Africa as a graduate attachee for the year while I was there. So I, seeing the man had some talent, harnessed him and got him involved in this project. We've ended up authoring this paper and another one together on the topic of oil in East Africa. And Adrian also, during that time, managed to spend some time as an advisor with the British High Commission in Tanzania, and for them he wrote a report on oil development, offshore oil development in Tanzania and Mozambique. So the background to the paper is that I was asked at one point last year by one of the larger oil companies in Africa to do a review of the political aspects of oil investment in the Eastern African region, which at the moment is seen by most of the major oil companies as an emerging frontier zone. I'll explain more about that in a moment. So I began to get interested simply because I was going to go and give a short talk, a short briefing. But as soon as I began to delve into what was available, having been told there was no data, I soon realized that we were swimming in data. And it was simply that no one had pulled it together. So that was basically what Adrian and I set about trying to do. So what I'm going to present falls into two main parts. And I should say this, because there's so much data around that people don't know about, this paper ended up being quite empirical. We felt we needed firstly to establish the facts. So it's very empirical. There are 287 footnotes, for example. I'm not going to read them all out, don't worry. But it's quite a nitty-gritty paper. And we tried to split it into two parts to make that less burdensome for the reader. So the first part deals with what's actually going on in each country. And we tried to document which oil companies are doing what, where, and what they're paying to do it. And that, after we found out where to look, was remarkably easy to find out. Astonishingly easy. The second part of the paper is then an analysis of some of the themes and issues that emerge for regional politics out of those considerations. And I'll go through three or four themes of that in the second half. So let me begin by giving a little bit of context. Writing in the Journal of African Affairs in 2007, Freinas and Paulo asked whether we were then standing at the brink of what they described as a new scramble for African oil, unquote. Now, while they rejected the idea that there was anything new about international struggles for access to African resources, they also noted that Africa was set to play a greater role in international oil markets in the years ahead, and that this would see the development of offshore oil reserves, most probably led by larger multinational companies, such as those who currently work in Nigeria, Libya, and Angola, but that there'd also be development by smaller exploration companies who would move in to establish what oil reserves there were onshore. Now, the expansion of oil developments in Africa that was foreseen in this paper by Freinas and Paulo was driven by their assessment of competition between the USA and China to secure markets. So it's market-driven, according to them. And also by the demands from growing economies such as Brazil, Malaysia, South Korea, and India. Now, new players who've come into the oil market in recent years seemed likely to behave in much the same way as their predecessors had done. And in Freinas and Paulo's opinion, there was little to suggest that any greater sense of corporate responsibility would have a significant impact on the oil industry if it broke into new frontier areas in Africa. So in other words, they're saying, if oil to you equals a curse and corruption, expect more of it. It's going to get worse. So they ended their article with a pessimistic appraisal that negative and economic social effects, I quote, of Africa's latest oil rush are likely to outweigh the benefits. Whatever we call them, they concluded, the new investments in African oil and gas may not necessarily be good news for ordinary Africans. Now, sadly to say, we started our research, Adrian and I, hoping to challenge that assertion. We've ended up confirming it. They're absolutely spot on. Now, 4 years on since that paper was authored in 2007, Africa's oil rush has quickened most dramatically in eastern Africa, which has been quite surprising, I think. Early phases of exploration carried out here by several major companies before 1980 revealed only very small finds on a scale that were not thought to be commercially viable. But since 2004, the huge expansion of the exploration and production sectors of the industry in this region has been led by numerous what are called smaller upstream companies. So these are not companies that are intending to produce oil and sell it. These are not the BPs and Shells. These are small companies you've never heard of who do the exploration. Now, with a successful example of Sudan in front of them as an East African country with oil, they set about their task. And they made a major oil discovery in 2006-2007 in the Lake Albert Basin of Uganda. And with that discovery, there was a further surge of companies into the region. So that by 2010, we can count more than 100 different oil exploration companies operating in eastern Africa. That's the companies bounded by Sudan in the north, down to Mozambique in the south, and including eastern DRC. Now, despite that enormous swelling of interest and activity, the oil industry in this region is still in its infancy. While some 20,000 oil wells have been sunk in North Africa, and 14,000 to date in West Africa, only 600 wells have ever been drilled in eastern Africa. So, and that includes Sudan, so it's tiny. Geologically more complex on the western side of the continent, oil exploration here has proved difficult. Data collected in the 1960s and 1970s revealed a plethora of salt basins and larger structures in some promising areas, leading analysts to conclude that although there might be plenty of gas in East Africa, there probably wouldn't be larger oil fields. Now that doesn't mean there's no oil. It means that at the commercial calculations made at that time, there wouldn't be fields large enough to be exploited. That's what's changed. Recent return of oil exploration companies to the region has been prompted by a combination of new factors. Improved technologies now allow more rapid and more complete and thorough surveys and have lowered the entry-level costs for smaller companies. Limited opportunities now are available in other regions of the world for acquiring new oil fields, so Africa has become relatively more important, and smaller companies are therefore pushed into what they now call these frontier regions. Larger corporations since the 60s have more or less got out of exploration onshore. It's too difficult, too politically nasty, and they farm it out, they subcontract it out to these smaller companies. So sometimes they are being funded in ways by the larger companies, but they are separate corporate entities. Moreover, meagre oil prices of between $15 and $25 per barrel in the early 2000s and late 1990s made frontier exploration financially unviable. But as prices rose dramatically in the period 2004 to 2008, peaking at $147 per barrel, smaller fields in frontier regions suddenly became commercially viable as never before. Well, although the oil price has fallen back again, they still remain commercially viable. It hasn't fallen back to its low. It's gone to a medium level. Global demand for oil was around 75 million barrels per day in 2000 by industry estimates. And the International Energy Agency estimates that this will nearly double by 2030, despite all our efforts to deal with global warming and all the rest of it. So demand for oil is rising as supply appears to be diminishing. So these are all reasons why East Africa becomes much more interesting now than it ever was in the 60s and 70s. In addition, I think we should note that there's now a significant regional market for oil and gas within East Africa itself, which wasn't there 40 or 50 years ago. To reduce dependence upon costly imports, the region must develop its own energy sector, whether this is through hydroelectric power, through oil, through gas, or alternative forms of generation. The bedeviled logistics involved in providing the partially landlocked region, served by only three ports of significance, Djibouti, Mombasa and Dar es Salaam, with fuel for generators, has now come to be recognised as a crucial constraint upon industrial development. Over the past decade, the logistics of fuel supply has reached breaking point, with Mombasa and Djibouti ports often completely bottlenecked. In Kenya, government officials have openly spoken of a regional energy crisis, as diesel prices in particular have spiralled upwards as problems of distribution have come to dominate. East Africa has the most expensive diesel on the planet. You can buy it cheaper in Mongolia. This is all because of the bottlenecks that occur in transportation. Now, the companies that have come in are sometimes described pejoratively as wildcatters. The numerous small oil and gas exploration companies that have found their way into the region since 2002 really don't have much capital. They're often small staffs. If you go to their website, you'll be astonished how amateurish it sometimes all looks. Yet these are people who are trading in stocks and shares and stakes in exploration blocks worth millions, even billions of dollars. So there's a real mismatch in the scale of monies that are involved and what these companies actually look like. The successful strike of a major field in Uganda's Lake Albert Basin was therefore a critical factor in 2006 in generating the momentum that carries this regional oil rush forward. The first exploration well was drilled in Lake Albert as long ago as 1938, would you believe? So we've known for 70 years and more that there was oil there. Yet no commercial development was begun until now. The importance of that 2006 find is that it is so large, and I'll say more about it in a moment, and it's linked now to understandings of the geological potential of neighbouring areas, that the assumption is that East Africa is going to become a major producer. Therefore, all these small companies that have no capital have been able to leverage capital in order to explore in this area like never before. Of course, the downside of that is that these companies get their capital by talking up the market. So the East African press is full of stories about oil finds all over the place, because that's how you increase your share value if you're a small oil company of this kind. So there's a lot of hype goes on, and it's quite difficult sorting the hype from the actual facts. So let me now begin by reviewing what's been going on in some of the different countries. And I'm going to do this quite briefly. I can, in questions, come back to any country you like and give you more details, tell you which companies, give you facts and figures, but I'm just going to very briefly skim through each country so you get a sense of the sheer scale of this. Let me start with Sudan, the country that you're almost certainly most familiar with. Sudan's already a very significant oil producer. It's an OPEC observer, and it has somewhere between 5 and 6.7 billion barrels of proven oil reserves, and probably more if they can only get that deal to find it. And there's still quite a bit of exploration work going on in Sudan. However, the two major civil wars since 55 have impacted upon the country's capacity and ability to deal with this oil. Exploration and exploitation of Sudan's oil resources has become very politicized and very controversial, and has been a major feature of the peace agreements that were signed a few years ago, and was a large shadow hanging over the referendum that took place in January this year. The problems in Sudan are that a lot of the oil is actually pretty adjacent to the border areas between north and south. Some of it actually cross-straddles the border, some of the fields actually straddle the border. So oil has become part of the contested nature of Sudan's settlement. Moreover, at the moment, the oil leaves Sudan, southern Sudan, and the central areas by pipelines that come from here and here all the way up the north to Port Sudan. So the north pumps out all of the south's oil, as well as its own oil. The relative importance of oil to the north and south is also structurally very different. If you calculate the income generated, the revenue generated by oil for the south, it's 98% of their income. If you calculate it for the north, which has a much smaller share of it, it's only 23% of their income. So that disproportion tells you that the south is totally dependent upon this oil. Without oil, the south does not have a budget, full stop. And in fact, about 18 months ago, when the government of Sudan did a provisional budget, the oil price was at $134 a barrel, so they set a budget according to that. It fell back down to $70 a barrel 2 months later. No one got paid for 3 months. I exaggerate slightly for effect, but that's the kind of effect it has. If you miss calculate on the oil price, you are stuffed. So this is a very important fact to note. Now, for Southern Sudan, then, the question is, how do you deal with this? The nationalist liberation struggle has been built on a war with the North. Do you want to carry on exporting your oil through the North and giving them a share? Or would you rather export it somewhere else and have it all to yourselves, paying someone else the rents necessary to export it, but not having to deal with your northern enemies? Well, that seems pretty clear to most nationalists in Sudan. And a few months ago, when the oil minister in Khartoum, who is a southerner, had the temerity to point out that there were no other oil pipelines, and that if the South did not export its oil north, what was it going to do with it? It couldn't drink it. He was deluged with comments into the website of the local newspaper, the Tribune in Khartoum, telling him that southerners would not accept for 1 minute continuing to export their oil north. So there's a political dilemma here for the government of the South. And it's also an economic dilemma. Had they wanted to export oil to the South, and they could do it by two or three routes, they could go down into Kenya and link up with oil pipelines at Eldoret. They could develop a pipeline through Ethiopia to Djibouti, and that indeed has been mooted, but of course the port of Djibouti at the moment couldn't handle it. But all those options will be considered. There's now discussion with Uganda about possibly having joint refinery and pumping facilities with Uganda. I'll come back to that in a few moments. So all these opportunities are there somewhere in the middle distance, but none of them are closer than 5 years away, because that's how long it'll take to build the refineries, the pipelines and the pumping stations that you'll need to develop that infrastructure. So if you're going to do this when Sudan finally becomes independent, as it will in July, you needed to have started in 2005, not now. And that is Sudan's major dilemma. So my guess is that, contrary to what some other analysts have said about Sudan and the importance of this politically, that the Southern Sudanese government will make a settlement with the North about the oil, whatever happens, Abyei. So even if those troop build-ups, Abyei, we heard about 10 days ago, turn out to be a small war, which I suspect they might, there'll still be a settlement about the oil, because the South has no choice. That settlement is likely, however, to be highly favourable to the North, because they control the pipeline, and there's nothing the South can do about that. So the politics of this are very fraught indeed, and I'm sure Douglas will ask me a question about it later. So I'll move on now to the next country. Sorry, I won't pass that one. DRC and Uganda, and I'm taking DRC and Uganda together because I'm only going to talk about Eastern DRC, not Western, and they're part of the same oil field. This is the area where in 2006, one of the wildcatter companies called Tullow, who are an Irish company, yes, the Irish have oil companies too, a Dublin-based company, made the oil find that's been confirmed in the Albert Basin of Lake Albert. That oil basin goes under the lake and comes out on the other side. Now, we don't know for sure yet, but all the best estimates in the industry are that the same quantity of oil exists on the DRC side as exists on the Uganda side. The confirmed findings on the Ugandan side at the moment is approximately 2 billion barrels. That is the third largest find ever made in Africa. And that counts everything in Angola, Chad, Libya, Nigeria, everywhere. This is simply massive, right? So this is completely transformative for Uganda's economy. And if you want to know why Museveni's been strutting his stuff with a devil-may-care attitude for the last 12 months, this is your answer. Because he's now got projections and figures in his development plans for the next 5 to 10 years that show that within 5 years, he won't need foreign aid. Not one penny of it will he need. So you can go hang. He can do just what Uganda likes. And it's already changing the dynamic of Uganda's relations with its neighbours and internationally because of the calculations he's making. But there are problems for Uganda too. Okay, oil. Wonderful. But where are we going to pump it to? And who are we going to sell it to? And here for Uganda, there are several conundrums to be addressed. The company that found the oil, Tullo, wanted initially to develop a partnership with some of the bigger companies that would produce the oil and refine it. So typically what happens with a find like this is a company like Tullo will then go to larger partners, and Tullo in fact went to CNOOC, who are the Chinese national oil company, and to Total France, and will make an agreement with CNOOC and Total France to buy out a proportion of Tullo's share in the franchise. So these two big companies, Total France and CNOOC, agreed with Tullo that they would provide all the infrastructure Tullo needed to get the oil out of the ground. So they'd provide the drills, the wells, the storage facilities, the pumps, etc. And that they would also help to pay for the construction of infrastructure that would get this oil to the Kenyan coast, where their ships would take most of it away for refining somewhere else. East Africa at the moment only has one oil refinery, and that is a small facility in Mombasa that's run by the Indian company Ensar. It is completely dilapidated, hasn't been properly serviced or repaired for a decade. God bless the Moi regime, who let it fall into complete disrepair. It's also at the centre of a deeply corrupt port authority, with people having to pay enormous sums of bribes to get their oil products through the port. So Mombasa's not the answer, it's the problem. So if you're going to take this oil out of Uganda and put it to Mombasa, you've got to deal with all the transaction costs that's going to add up to. Now the Ugandans are already very sensitive about this, because in the post-election violence of January, February 2008, the transport routes that they rely on through Kenya came to a complete halt. And there were very heavy losses made by all Ugandan businesses and companies that trade out through Kenya. And they realised that they were completely dependent upon those transport routes. Our own Andrew Rugasira, Andrew's not here tonight, but Andrew's coffee company lost a significant amount of money with coffee being on the roads in Kenya when that violence happened. So he's an example of one business, only one, that suffered, but many others did too. So Ugandans since then have been exploring other things than the Kenyan route, because they feel it's too fragile, and they also don't trust Kenyans. They think the Kenyans will milk them and will rent-seek and will be corrupt. And experience tells them they're right, because that's what's happened in the past. So the Ugandans are looking for alternatives. Now, Museveni eventually got advice from the Norwegians, who are oil experts, after all, and do run a pretty successful oil economy. And one writer recently described NORAD in Africa, the Norwegian aid agency, as the oil tooth fairy. They come and give advice to African governments about how to manage their oil economies. So Museveni consulted the oil tooth fairy and got some good advice, which was really, look, why don't you try and refine this stuff in Uganda? Because the difference between what you will make for your own economy, for your revenue, for your exchequer, by refining locally, is several times greater than what you will make if you let these companies export it. Moreover, the oil companies work on something called PSAs. They make agreements. These PSAs are agreements made, production sharing agreements made, before the oil is discovered. So when Tullo took this contract, and what they do is that you'll notice on this map, those at the back we can't see too well, but there are several blocks set out, and each block is a franchise. And each wildcatter bids for a franchise and pays a sum of money to get the franchise. And the sum of money typically for those franchises, which were sold off in 2004, was around $500,000 to $1.5 million. Very cheap. Really cheap. Compared with the kind of cost that you might pay if you knew there was oil there and you thought you were going to develop it. So they get their share initially for a relatively cheap sum. Why is that? Well, in frontier areas, companies like Tullo would argue they're taking a risk. Those franchises have now been repartitioned by the Ugandans and are now selling, well, will tender this year, probably for about $15 million to $50 million each. So once you find oil, it ramps up. But before you found oil, the risk is all with the company, not with the government. So these agreements are structured in such a way that benefits the company. However, the agreements are not good. They were first devised as a means of getting oil out of Iraq after the first invasion, when there was no government, but American companies wished to extract the oil. So PSAs were used as a legal device for allowing the company to take oil out and then pay the government back a share later. And the point is that all the accounting of this lies with the company. So the company can transfer any benefits to its own balance sheet and any costs to the government side. And that tends to be what happens. So the government gets a share of the profit after the company has taken out all the cost. And depending on how clever the accountants are, that may be a rather smaller sum of money than we were anticipating. So these agreements are universally unpopular, but African governments in frontier areas tend to go in for them because that's the way the oil industry now works. So what has happened in Uganda is that Tullo has decided, okay, it's found the oil, it's going to try and go into partnership with Canuck and Total France, and it's then going to try and export the oil and have it refined somewhere else. Museveni says, no, I want to refine it here. But Tullo says, well, hang on, we've got an agreement, we're allowed to do this and we want to. It's not up to you to decide. And Museveni says, wait a minute, you're in Uganda. This is my oil. Exactly. And Tullo said, no, 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 we have an agreement. Now, I don't know what Museveni said next, but I can guess it wasn't very polite. Because where this ended up was in court. Because what then happened was that Tullo decided that they would buy out their partner company, a smaller company called Heritage Oil. Now, these companies change names, and the same people own them all, right? It's a kaleidoscope of common interests. So they decided to buy out the share in Heritage, and they needed to pay around $1.4 billion to do this. Now, that sounds like a lot of money, but for two oil companies doing this, this is a paper transaction. No one actually hands over the banknotes. So it's not real, but that was the figure. Now, when Museveni got to hear about this, he decided that he'd have some capital gains tax on that, thank you very much. Now, the problem is that there's not actually any law in the Ugandan tax that says you can do that. He doesn't have a law that describes capital gains tax in this way. But he sought to impose it as a way of stopping the oil companies selling what he thought was his asset to someone else to exploit. So a legal wrangle ensued last year, in 2010, about whether Tullo and Heritage could do this, and if they could do it, where the money went. On the back of this, Museveni started negotiating with other oil companies about exploiting the oil. So trying to cut Tullo and Canuck and Total out of the story. And he's been talking to one or two other companies who I won't mention because those agreements are still going on, but we do know who they are. He also took advice, as I said earlier, about getting the oil refined locally. And he's come up with some alternative schemes. So what he'd now like to do is to build a refinery somewhere in Uganda, and they've decided that Homa District will be where it will be, that refinery will produce oil for the local regional market. And it's reckoned within 3 to 5 years that a refinery at Homa Bay can be producing oil that will meet about half the regional demand. Regional demand is about 120,000 barrels per day for the whole of Eastern Africa. So they can meet about half of that within 3 to 5 years, and all of it within 10 years. So Museveni is positioning Uganda to be the oil hub for Eastern Africa, supplying oil to anyone in the region who wants to buy it. And he'll be doing that while the Sudanese are still pumping theirs north. Unless, of course, he builds a pipeline from southern Sudan to Houma. Now there's an idea. Discussions are currently going on, because that's a much shorter route than anyone that would take you to the sea. So can he persuade the southern Sudanese that's what they should do? The problem there is then that you'd need a much bigger refinery, more capacity, because you'd be doubling or even tripling the amount of oil that would be coming to the refinery in the early years. So that's not a done deal by any means, and it might, well, there's lots of reasons why it might go wrong. But that link indicates the way that this is changing the whole dynamic of politics around these countries. Oh, by the way, another reason just to, on passing, this is one of the anal facts I like learning on this project. was that the reason, one of the reasons why it's not economic to pump this Ugandan oil all the way to Mombasa is that it is in fact what is called a waxy crude. Sounds like something really not worth talking about, doesn't it? But it's a waxy crude. And therefore, if you're going to pump it along a long pipeline, the pipeline needs to be heated because the oil otherwise won't flow. And the cost of heating the pipeline over such a length, it's 1,700 something kilometres, was over $1 billion per annum. So when they actually did the feasibility study on the pipeline, it wasn't feasible anyway. So it was never going to happen. And Tullow, remember, were trying to sell out their share without acknowledging that fact to anyone who was listening or prepared to buy. So that thing about oil companies talking up something and not necessarily giving away all the facts is very much part of the story. I could say lots more about the Uganda situation because they had a big court case with Tullow that I can go into, but let me move on. How am I doing for time, Nick?
Good.
Okay, fine. So let's now go to Somaliland and Puntland. I bet you didn't think we were going there. But this is another area where since the 1940s we've known there's oil in the Sula, Sugal and Nebel valleys. And in the last 4 years, the wildcats have gone in there also, and they have discovered, they've made two oil strikes. Now, we don't yet know how significant these fields are, but the rumours in the industry are that they're certainly commercial, and they're also adjacent to large gas fields, which enhances the commercial value of them. And that knowledge has inspired lots of other speculation to the south of Ethiopia, I'll come to in a moment, on the understanding that this geology might extend a bit further. And what they're doing here is that this oil field is the south side of the Yemeni fields, under the Red Sea, the same geology, comes up on the south side. So the potential for, you know, a billion barrel field here is not unreasonable. But no one's yet put a figure on this field. Now, the reason they've not put a figure on it is that whenever they start to try and get better seismic surveys, the Somalilanders and the Puntlanders go to war. And the reason is, quite simple, that here's Puntland, here's Somaliland, the border between the two run somewhere down here, or here, or here, depending on which government you believe. And hey, look, the oil is right in the middle on the disputed area. So after the first oil find was made in 2005, Somaliland's army invaded the Nobel Valley and sat there for a while. Now, none of us remember this, do we? Because we're all looking at something else at the time. It wasn't big enough news. It didn't feature in our newspapers. But they moved into the Nobel Valley and they took the oil installations. And in the process, some Changin oil workers got killed. Since then, they've invaded again, and this time they've secured those oil stations properly, and the Somaliland army is now holding the oil area, and the Puntlanders are complaining about it. So oil companies have been a little bit reluctant to push into this area and to start talking about development work, because there clearly isn't the right circumstances to make that happen. There's also been enormous disputes about whether Puntland and Somaliland have the authority to give rights in oil to anyone. Are these recognised sovereign governments? Not by anybody else in the world, just by themselves. So, should in fact, if you want an oil tender for this part of Somaliland or Puntland, shouldn't you go to Mogadishu and talk to the transitional government? That's what they say you should do. But the Puntlanders and the Somalilanders don't really agree. So I'm not going to labour the point, but you can see that this is deeply fraught and is going to go nowhere fast, but there is significant oil here. Let me move on then to a very different case, and that of Tanzania. Now here, I'm just going to talk about the offshore stuff in Tanzania. There is some onshore stuff as well in the west, and that's increasingly attracting attention. It looks like there might be oil fields on the west, on the east side of Lake Tanganyika, and that these could be significant. There are several tenders going out there now to oil companies, but the bulk of the interest the last 5-6 years has been in these offshore plots. Now, because they're offshore, this is, generally speaking, these offshore blocks are very large, they're very deep water, they're beyond the shelf, the coastal shelf, So you need high-tech, expensive equipment to do any work at all, even a survey. So there are very few wildcatters in the offshore area. This tends to be larger oil companies, the ones you've heard of, or their subsidiaries. Some of them have smaller subsidiaries that do exploration work, who do this work. Often they do it in partnerships with one another. So you'll find Chinese oil here in partnership with Total France, or with Eni, or with Agip, whatever it may be, because the costs are so high and the risks are pretty acute. They've concentrated their efforts mostly in the blocks behind Zanzibar, partly because geologically they're the blocks that are most likely, they think, to come up with oil and, or with gas, but also because they're the blocks from which you'd have the shortest pipelines, because the assumption is you're going to pipe this into Dar es Salaam. There's not at the moment any plans to have refineries elsewhere on the coast, although I think that will come in the fullness of time. There have been two significant offshore discoveries, Tanzania already. Again, we don't know how large they are, but they're certainly creating a lot of excitement in the industry. That goes along with large discoveries of gas that straddle the onshore and offshore fields. So in central Tanzania, behind Dar es Salaam, you have the Songo gas fields, and these go under the water also, so that they extend further into the ocean. These gas fields are really large. They're among the largest anywhere known. And this has prompted the energy companies to think that they can do liquid gas transition here, and they can use that for energy production. So Dar es Salaam is set to have one of the earliest liquid gas stations that they hope will provide energy to power the city within the next 3 to 5 years. Now, this is an example of how the technologies are opening up new possibilities. 5 years ago, we didn't know how to do this. So now, gas fields that were previously thought to be uncommercial can be commercial, because if you can pump this gas to a factory that can produce the energy from it, you're in business. And in fact, Eni, the Italian company, are in Nigeria developing a plant now that will do just that, so they don't have to burn off gas in the oil wells in Nigeria. Those flares you see in the Nigeria oil wells are the gas being burnt off. So they've now got a technology, you don't need to do that. You can take the gas and use it and turn that stuff into energy. So that is what's driving the Tanzanian side of the story. Move on. Kenya. Poor Kenya. What can we say? They so desperately want to find oil and they can't. Now that's not quite true, because they did actually find some. In the late 1980s, Shell, one of their small subsidiary exploration companies, made a good discovery of oil up in south of Lake Turkana at a place called Loporot, south of Lankatang. And that discovery was thought to be commercially significant. Shell made a press announcement at the time. It was reported in the press, Kenya's found oil, everybody cheered. But no figures were ever announced, because Shell then went into a huddle to renegotiate their agreement with the Kenyan government. Now, this was before PSAs, right? This is before the agreements that we now have. So they tried to negotiate a contract with the Moi government. Now, no one knows quite what happened, but 1 year later, Shell walked away. And it's always been said in Nairobi that the extractions being sought in backhand payments by the Moi government were so acute that even Shell couldn't swallow them, and that they simply walked away from Kenya. Following this, from the period, well, about 1892 up until 2002, the Kenyans could not get oil companies to come into the country, because the vibe around the Shell experience was so negative that other companies didn't want to get involved. It's also suspected, though no one will confirm it, that the ministry was asking for too much upfront payment to allow companies to operate. So you only began to get, around 1997-98, one or two of the Australian and South African companies came in and took some offshore concessions and began exploring there. And then after 2002, when the Moi government went out, suddenly there was a flood of companies back into Nairobi. And from 2004 onwards, as the oil price climbed, that flood turned into a torrent. And Kenya now has as many exploration blocks as any other country in the area, and has more companies actually trying to find oil. Now, the prospects for finding oil in Kenya are quite good, according to the geology, but so far there's been no major find. There have been some significant gas finds, but these are not reckoned to be anywhere near as commercial as those in neighbouring Tanzania. So Kenya's problem has been, if it can't find oil, how does it benefit from this oil bonus that the region's having? How does it make this work? So for Kenya, this is a real problem, because Kenya depends economically upon its role as an entrepôt for this region. At the moment, all of the oil, petroleum, gas, paraffin, diesel, all of this enters Eastern Africa through Mombasa. Every drop of it. Every drop of it that goes to Uganda, to Rwanda, to Burundi, to Eastern DRC, to Northern Tanzania, to Southern Ethiopia, all comes in through Mombasa. Now that gives Kenya a significant advantage as an energy hub. Now, if Uganda builds its refinery, that's all gone. Kenya will no longer hold that position. Some economists in Nairobi estimate that between 2004 and 2009, when Kenya was running at growth rates above, economy of growth rates above 5%, that around a third to a half of that was actually the transshipment of oil and petroleum products. So this comprises a significant chunk of the economy. Now, that also causes Kenya's neighbours some problems, right? Uganda has the most expensive diesel in Africa because Kenya taxes it so highly on the tariffs to re-export it to Uganda. So Uganda's imports of petroleum products stand at 15% of GDP. 15%. So there's a huge incentive for the Ugandans to do something about that and to remove the Kenyan stranglehold and dominance over oil and energy products. The Kenyans know this. So they are very worried by all these developments. This could knock a very big hole in their economy. So what are they doing about it? Well, the Lamu Basin Development Authority has been set up. And here we enter the realms, perhaps, of fantasy, but who knows? What has been proposed is that a new port will be built on Kenya's north shore, up behind the island of Lamu, right up here near the Somali border. Up there at the moment, well, a few miles away behind Manda Island, the next island down, there is a Kenyan military facility that is shared with the Americans and is used for most of the operations that are mounted in Somalia and the Horn of Africa more generally. It's the second base for HOA, which is the American listening post at Djibouti. So all the American intels are run out of it as well. And when the drones go into southern Somalia, that's where they come from. So there's already a naval base there. So the Americans came up with the idea, well, if there's a naval base, why can't there be a commercial port also? Well, that's all well and good, the port facility could be built, but of course, Lamu's in the middle of nowhere. There is not even a road to Lamu. In the wet season, you have to fly in, because the Tana River floods, and the road is washed out. There's no bridge on the Tana. It's a ford. So this place is in the middle of nowhere. It needs a complete transport infrastructure to link it into the rest of Kenya, never mind anywhere else. So what the Kenyans have come up with, and you can't fault them for energy and commitment, they've come up with a fantastic scheme to develop what they're calling a second transport corridor. And this is a scheme that will involve not only building a commercial port at Lamu alongside the naval port, but also building a town there, an industrial town, that will process oil and gas, they hope, that they're going to find offshore. They're also going to build a railway line. And that railway line is going to go from Lamu across to Isiolo, and then it's going to go north to Moyale. And from Moyale, it's going to go round the south end of Lake Turkana to Loichokio, where they're going to build an oil refinery. If the Sudanese agree to ship their oil out to there instead of to Houma. So you see the games that are going on here? And then that railway from La Chugio is going to go on to, come on, any guesses?
Juba.
Juba. And they're hoping they can persuade the Ethiopians to build a connecting line that will come down from Addis Ababa and link Addis Ababa and then also go on to Kampala. Now, all these schemes, you may think, I mean, anyone who's been to this part of the world, you're going to giggle at this, really, because there is nothing there. But they're also going to build three airports and create two major new industrial hubs. One at Isiolo. What if anyone's told the cattle herders who live there? But anyway, these are grand schemes. Now, we could dismiss this very lightly, but there's been a feasibility study done by the Tokyo Ports Authority that has costed all of this. And there's an investment brochure going around inviting international investors. This is serious stuff. All of this might not happen. Now, if that railway line is built, I'll eat my hat and everyone else's. But some of it will happen. I think the roads probably will happen. I think the port probably will happen. I think the industrialization of some complex behind Lamu Bay probably will happen. And this is all being fueled on the expectation that oil economies can fund this. Because you have something valuable to export. Therefore, it makes it worthwhile doing. It's also partly carrying on the basis that Chinese and Indian firms might come in and help with infrastructure costs. There's all kinds of issues going into this. But this is the most ambitious development plan ever put forward for any part of Eastern Africa. And although we may scoff, and most commentators have scoffed, bits of this will happen, and it will make a difference. Now, as to the oil question, I don't think the Sudanese are going to be that keen on waiting for the Kenyans to raise enough money to build this refinery at the Southern Lake to come. But I think the Southern Sudanese don't trust the Kenyans very much. They think that they'll be extracted too much. They probably have a closer relationship with Museveni. They'll probably go for the Homolay option if they're faced with a choice of the two. But if the Kenyans can incentivize this sufficiently, if they can find ways of sugaring the pill, of making it a sweeter, more profitable deal, then the Sudanese will go where the money is. And that's partly why the railway line is in this plan, because it's seen as a way of integrating the Sudan into the region. And remember as well that the Southern Sudanese have said they will be applying to join the East African Community as soon as they're able to do so as a sovereign state. And the Kenyans have said, of course, we'll support that. And you will, of course, want to help us build this river, won't you? So there'll be conditions, I'm sure, put in to the Southern Sudanese participation in the East African Community around this scheme and its importance to Kenya. So again, the geopolitics of this, very interesting. I could say a lot more about Kenya and its dilemmas and this Lamu project, but let me move on to the last of our countries, Ethiopia. Now, Ethiopia has probably had the least success in its oil and gas exploration thus far. But it's been typical of Ethiopians, have been very robust and determined to pursue it. So Ethiopia, none of this, devising franchise areas on the basis of seismic maps. Ethiopia's just put a grid down on the map and told the companies to bid for it. So there we are, the companies have bid for it, and there are lots of companies. Now the problem here is that the bulk of the areas that are considered to be geologically most promising are here. 20, 21, 17, 18, and 19, right in the Ogaden Triangle. So they're in the contested area of Ethiopia. And those, the northern two, they found oil already in 15, in 11, and they've had non-confirmed positive finds in 20. So there is oil and gas there. The question only is now, is it commercial? So when you hear stories from Human Rights Watch, the Ethiopian government going in and their army clearing people out of certain parts of the Ogaden, there may be more to the story now than you realise. It's not just about clearing up guerrillas and rebels. It's also about setting things down so you can start to develop an infrastructure that will allow you to explore this possibility more thoroughly. Inspired by this, Meles has recently put up franchises for other blocks in the country to the centre and north and to the south, and particularly this block down here, which is close to my heart, at least the Omo block in the southwest here, this was put out and given to a company called African Oil Corporation without any tendering process. The Ethiopians just awarded it to them. And they did that on the back of receiving a report about the oil finds in Loperot, south of Turkana, and I'm hearing arguments from African Oil Corporation that this, the geology that found oil down here was the same on the other side of the lake. So they've given the exploring rights in the OMO to this oil company. So along with everything else in the lower oil, we now have an oil exploration company in there working as well. So I think also in Ethiopia's case, it's just a question of time before something fairly major and commercial is found. I suspect it won't be down in the OMO, thank goodness. I think it'll be in the Ogaden, but that will have its own kind of problems for the Ethiopian government. The last point about Ethiopia is they are the only one of these countries that has awarded tenders to one of its own companies. They set up a parastatal oil company, oil exploration company, and got in some expatriate staff to train people up, and have given that company several of these franchises. And have also insisted that in all the franchises where oil is most likely to be found, the Ethiopian company has a joint share. Now again, this is very typical of the way the Ethiopians do their business. They own their development in a way that some of the other countries don't. And if there is corruption, it's of a different kind than you see in Kenya or in Uganda or elsewhere. So the Ethiopians are handling this in a way that will probably see greater benefits accruing to the Ethiopian exchequer if oil is found than in the other countries, where it's really not clear that oil finds are going to benefit the exchequer. They may benefit the oil companies and those getting the backhanders and the brown envelopes rather more. Okay, I must be just a bit done.
5 minutes?
Yeah, so I'll start to round up now. Okay, so those are the countries, and in going through each country, I've tried to cover the themes and issues that emerge. There's a lot more that one could say about things like the contracts in Uganda, the building of oil refineries, the Lamu Development Basin Authority and its implications. There's more that one could say about Sudan's role and what Sudan will do in the future. All of these are things that can be discussed in our questions and can be gone into in enormous length. But what I'm trying to get across here is the sense that this is transforming the regional geopolitics in a way that nothing else has done, in my experience, over the last 3 decades. And I think we stand at the cusp of a major transformation in this region, where the familiar pattern of Kenya as a dominant economy is no longer going to be the case. And Kenyan investors in Nairobi we talked to on this project have already recognised that. And they are doing things about it. They've realised, this is one of the reasons why the East African community has been revived. They've realised they need regional friends to make this work. So some of them are very wisely trying to transit Kenya to a different kind of regional hub, where instead of dominating and extracting rents from everyone, it actually acts as a facilitator and gets paid legitimate fees for that, rather than by tackling everyone else out of existence. Now that could be a positive, if it's handled properly. But it's a big if. And we don't quite know how the modalities of that yet would look like, what they would be. And I think no one does, we're all guessing. If this Lamu stuff comes off, even some of it, that could be transformative too. It could create new opportunities, new possibilities. But until we see where this money is going to go, how it's going to be invested, it's difficult to know what the outcome will be. So, rather unsatisfactory, I don't have a clear conclusion. I don't know what the outcome is going to be. But I do think that Fryness and Polo, where I started, in their comments on a new scramble for African oil, I think they were right to say that it's unlikely to be something that will bring immediate direct benefits to the average African in Eastern Africa. The cost of oil exploration and oil production are too high, the risks are too great, the amount of investment going into all these projects is simply enormous. That oil refinery that I talked about, Homa, is going to cost over $1.5 billion to build, never mind to run. So by the time everybody takes their cut of that, I wonder how much will be left for the average Ugandan. Probably not that much to begin with. But once oil begins to be pumped and annual incomes come in, that's when the distribution factor ought to kick in. But will it? Will these states by then have moved to a situation where they are less neo-patrimonial, where there's less corruption, where there's stronger revenue authorities, where we can actually achieve something through that extra income. I reckon we've got 5 years to do it. Thank you.